Hello, and welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. I'm Craig Dale. I'm the Head of Policy and Research at Commonweal. In 2019, Commonweal published our Common Home Plan, the world's first fully budgeted, national-scale Green New Deal blueprint. Around a third of the cost of that transition, £40 billion, was marked to pay for the retrofitting of Scotland's existing homes to bring them up to an energy efficiency standard sufficient to meet climate goals while also eliminating fuel poverty in Scotland. This one task is perhaps the hardest challenge of the whole Green New Deal, but only because of the scale of it. The solutions themselves are already possible. However, we currently treat retrofitting as an action for individuals, like redecorating your kitchen, rather than a collective action that affects entire communities. My guest this week is Tom Knuckles, co-founder of Local Homes and a member of Commonweal's Energy Working Group, here to talk about the retrofitting challenge and how community-level action leads to better outcomes for everyone. Hello, Tom. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Craig, for having me along. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, who are you? How did you get interested in retrofitting that led you to found a company?
Sure. So, well, first of all, as soon as I start speaking, people will probably hear that I'm Australian. I moved from Australia to Scotland in 2019, and these days I sort of self-describe myself as a new Scot. There seemed like there was a label and a terminology available to me, so I went, I'll identify with that, because I think we might have made Scotland our home permanently. As part of making Scotland and particularly Glasgow my new home, I'm really interested in contributing to my new community, but also continuing the previous career that I'd been working on in Australia. So, since about 10 years, I've been working in the community energy sector, so sort of community owned, community controlled energy projects. And what that's mostly meant, or primarily meant, has been helping community organisations in creating new energy generation assets. Think of solar panels on the roof of a brewery owned by the community, wind turbine on the hill of a nearby town where the townsfolk are having some say and control and perhaps benefit from the presence of that wind turbine. But wherever you go, whenever you speak to the people who are perhaps the peak bodies sitting above community energy organizations, or the academics looking at what community energy means, they always describe community energy in a common framing. And what they say is that community energy is where something along the lines of community energy is where local people, or perhaps a community of interest, have a greater say and control over what the future energy system is going to look like, as well as a greater opportunities to participate in owning and benefiting from that future energy. And the crucial thing here is that they always say that energy can mean a wide variety of things, from energy generation through to conservation of energy, and including other aspects such as the retailing of energy. So while we might think that community energy is very much the domain of energy generation, wind turbines and solar panels and hydro schemes, it's always there lurking in the background that community energy is actually not really so much about that. It's about the levels of ownership, control, and benefit that communities have in the future energy system more holistically. And so when I arrived in Scotland, I'm really motivated in this work to make a positive contribution to decarbonizing our economy so that the impacts of climate change can be as minimized as possible and managed as much as possible. And when I arrived in Scotland, it was fairly apparent to me that while the decarbonisation of our electricity grid is by no means a finished job, it's well underway, and the establishment of community energy in that space is really firm. And it didn't really feel to me like I could make a big contribution. And I'm seeing and hearing signals from a variety of sources, including the Scottish Government, saying how important it is that we decarbonise transport and our buildings. And one of those in particular struck a chord with me. And so I became really motivated to try and find something that I could do here in my new home of Glasgow that was about decarbonising of our buildings. And going back to around about 2020, sort of late 2020, I was at an online conference during one of the lockdowns, and in the sort of fringes of that event, while I was chatting to chat in the chat rooms, I met another person based in part of Glasgow that I knew, Chris Karras, and he was working towards creating a retrofit intermediary. We really struck it off and decided that the best thing to do was to create a new organization. So that's really the story behind what led me to get into decarbonizing buildings, retrofit, and why fundamentally decided to create LocoHome. But I want to talk more about that. So, yeah, I'll let you sort of respond to that and prompt me on there, Craig.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting concept, looking at the energy system in a whole, that community ownership is, it's not just about the generation, it's about the demand side as well, that saving a megawatt via community action is just as valid as generating a megawatt from community actions.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, my work in community energy has been largely driven by this idea that we really need to make sure that the response to climate change, and in particular the decarbonisation of our energy systems, is done in a way that is as fast and as fair as possible. So fast and fair has really been my overarching driving motivation and guiding principle for my work in community energy. And I see these two concepts as being really inextricably linked with each other. Because, of course, if we don't act fast on decarbonizing, it definitionally won't be fair. So the people that are most impacted by climate change, if we don't act fast, the impacts will be greater. Those people who least contributed will be the ones that have the greatest impact. The impacts will be greater. It'll be even more unfair. But the reverse is also true, because I think if we build the future energy systems that are fair, it'll contribute towards the transition happening faster. And I think perhaps the best way of explaining that is to talk about that in the negative. And I think there's several examples of stories we can tell to demonstrate this. So if we implement our new energy systems in the same old top-down approach, we use the same old ownership structures, if we fail to consult local communities who have a lot of knowledge and wisdom and actually have very legitimate concerns about what the future is going to look like, then we risk activating the power of veto that exists in communities. And so we've seen that power of veto being activated to some extent in the UK politically, when people have campaigned for or against onshore wind. So in England, we've had an effective ban on onshore wind. And I would argue that a major contributing factor to that has been a failure to adequately engage, to put people in their communities into the frame as we roll out that new energy infrastructure. That is, I would describe that as a soft power of veto that communities have. If they're not consulted enough, if they feel that their benefits are not outweighing the very real impacts and very real perceived concerns that they have, then they might choose to mobilize, organize, and exercise that sort of soft power of veto. And then if we think about what's happening in the household space, decarbonizing our homes, homeowners have a very hard power of veto. And that extends not only to a conscious thinking power of veto, oh, I've considered whether or not I should get a heat pump, and I've decided that I'm not going to do it, type of, you know, I've consciously decided that I'm not going to participate, but also even just a failure to think about it. not thinking about whether or not I need to do something is the same as deciding not. It's like a veto by default. And so I think it's really important that we consider that and come up with approaches and methods for avoiding people in their communities from exercising that power of veto.
I guess we also see it at the very other end of the private sector, where we've seen in recent months with the energy crisis, with energy price spikes, and then large fossil fuel companies generating record levels of profit and actively responding to that profit spike by saying that they were pulling back investment in renewables.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I think people are naturally cynical about what the motivations of big business is. I think people have become very jaded about the ability for big government to act in their best interests. But we do actually need the government in all of this, and we do need big business to be acting responsibly in all of this. And so for us at Loco Home, we consider that sort of challenge that in particular when it comes to government. Governments are not going to take action to motivate, to force households to retrofit their homes. It's just not something they are likely to do, at least not until they can be very confident that taking that action is acting in the prevailing mood, that there's also a very clear pathway for how that can be done. Now, until we can provide the government with that signal, they're not going to do it. And so right there is one of the fundamental reasons why we exist as an organization. Right at our core is a theory of change that says governments are not going to act. They're not going to force households to do retrofit to make their homes a lot more carbon efficient. And we probably don't want them to do forcing people anyway, to be honest, but we want them to provide incentives, primarily the carrot and stick balance, I think. But government's not going to act until we can demonstrate to them the demand is there, the support is there, and that there is a clear pathway. And that's what our organization is fundamentally about. And we think the way that we can do that is to work locally. So we're really only an organization that's focused on Glasgow, Greater Glasgow. And that's because we want to be rooted in the local community. Like we live here, we're from here. Oh, I'm not from here, but you know what I mean. It's my new home. we live here. We're part of this community, and we're not outsiders saying this is what is right for Glasgow. We're saying here we are in Glasgow. What's right for us? And we're building the trust and tapping into the relationships that naturally exist within the various communities that make up Glasgow. And as part of that, what we think we can do is solve two of the biggest sort of most intractable problems with retrofitting of our homes. And that is that there is simultaneously a lack of customers stepping forward and saying they want to retrofit their homes. And there's simultaneously a lack of suppliers who are ready, willing, and able to provide the services and the products for retrofit. So I think we'll probably talk about those two things a little bit later in the interview.
Actually, I was going to bring it up right now, because that is something that in my own retrofitting journey has impacted me directly. Listeners can't see the loft behind me that we converted into our home office. But when we were insulating this, we were actually determined that we didn't want, the standard plastic foam insulation. We wanted to do something a bit more ecological. And at the time, there were news stories about sheep farmers in Scotland burning their wool because it was cheaper to do that than to sell the wool at market. They were losing money by selling it. So our impulse was to try and get sheep wool insulation, and we could not get it. There was no supply of this wool anywhere that we could get. We ended up getting wood fiber insulation, although it was imported from the south of England. It's great, but I would have much rather it produced locally. So we got a solution, not the best solution, but certainly not the worst. So we were right in the middle of that kind of market failure.
Yeah, and market failure is commonly a sort of language that we use, but it's more than just a market failure. It's a market and regulatory. Well, yeah, we're going to resist the urge for this conversation to go in a new direction altogether. My view is that markets don't exist without regulation. So by definition, a market failure is also a regulatory failure. So there,
Agreed. So can you tell us how Local Homes fits into your local community and how you're helping that community to take on retrofitting projects?
Yeah, so first of all, let's talk a little bit about Glasgow and just sort of try and understand the sort of the nature of the problem and the scale of the challenge, and we'll talk about how we sort of think we fit in. First of all, various data points on just how much of our carbon emissions come from heating our homes. But there was a UK government, BEIS, now Department of Energy, what is it? Energy, DESNZ, Energy something and Net Zero.
I was literally emailing them today about a matter, and I still couldn't tell you what the department's called.
Energy security is what it is. That's right. Energy security and net zero. In 2021, they were estimating that 34% of Glasgow's carbon emissions, that's primary carbon emissions, of course, come from heating our homes. So a third of our emissions come from heating our homes. And that's a huge proportion. And it's vital that we tackle these big contributions to carbon. But also, in Glasgow, our housing stock is overwhelmingly dominated by privately owned housing. Yes, there's a very, vibrant social housing sector and all of those housing associations in Glasgow, because Glasgow City Council doesn't own and operate the social housing anymore. But I believe the statistics are somewhere in the range of like 70% of the houses that need to be retrofitted in Glasgow are privately owner-occupied, and about a 12% are privately rented. So somewhere above 80% of the homes in Glasgow are privately owned. And from what we can see, virtually nobody is tackling that privately owned space. There's a lot of work being done for retrofitting social housing and houses that are fuel poor, which might cut into some of the privately owned housing, but generally there's nothing to look at the sort of able to pay private housing, the not able to pay private housing. And if we think about that power of veto problem, that's exactly where that exists. We're not going to get into achieving our targets on decarbonizing housing unless we can tackle the privately owned space. So that's where we fit. And as I mentioned earlier, we're very much about building trust and building trust between the customers and the supply side, the households and the supply side. And so what we decided to do was, because trust is so central to what we're trying to achieve, we decided to create ourselves not just as a not-for-profit. We are not-for-profit. We're a community interest company, but also as a cooperative. So we're owned by our members, owned and controlled by our members. They don't decide to become members because they're motivated by becoming rich. We're not for profit. They're motivated by joining because they want to contribute to this future endeavor about decarbonizing our homes. And the members are, membership is open to homeowners in Glasgow, people that work in the supply chain. So that means primarily trades, professional building professionals, and also our workers. So we're kind of like a work co-op, but we've opened up membership to a broader range of participants. We're trying to build trust that way. And what else to say about that? Where do we fit in the ecosystem in Glasgow? Well, we're not planning to be an organization that delivers retrofit like works. So we're not going to become an insulation installation company. We're not going to start supplying retrofit products into the marketplace. But what we will do is we'll focus very strongly on supporting households through their customer journey from the earliest stage of building their knowledge and awareness of what retrofit is, through to planning their retrofit, implementing the works required to make their homes more energy efficient, and then beyond that, the post-implementation monitoring and evaluation and making sure that the homes are performing as they're supposed to be. And because we're relatively new and we're starting ourselves up and we don't have some very rich external philanthropic funder who's dropped a bunch of money on us to support us, although if anybody's listening and they want to do that, that'd be great. We're having to build this thing on our own. We start where we can. And the place that we've started is with some modest funding from places like Glasgow City Council and other third sector support organisations in Scotland and further afield. We've been able to run information events, and we're just restarting our series of informational webinars. First of those for the new season is actually kicking off today. So that's about building the awareness and the knowledge. And the second thing that we're currently doing is we're offering a home retrofit assessment service to primarily houses, but also flats, tenements.
So one of the challenges that a lot of people have faced with their own retrofitting journey is kind of a sense of having to do it alone. Is just trying to work out what to do, where to go for help, where to go for funding, is that a big barrier to the retrofitting challenge at the moment?
Well, indeed. And look, the reason why there's not more homes stepping up and saying, yes, I want to retrofit my home is complex. But one of the key reasons why that's not happening, one of the key barriers in the way of households is that it's not widespread and mainstream. There's very little information about it. And we're really currently very much in the realm of sort of early adopters. We haven't got to the point where the market's developed. We've got all of the knowledge and the awareness that's already built. It's just a few people, I would say maybe even before the early adopters, we're actually the innovator stage, people who are willing to take risks at such an early stage. And when people like you do step up and say, you know, I'm hearing more and more about the fact that it wasn't just enough to do double glazing and a bit of loft insulation. We need to go further. We need to do things like putting wool or wood fiber insulation into the walls, making sure it's all joined up, etc. Once you start looking at it, you actually quickly realize that it's really complicated. And there's a bunch of confusing and conflicting information, such as, for example, in the world of heat pumps. And I won't go there, but there's a good example of how there's good, you know, loads of conflicting information about heat pumps. Do they work or do they not work? That's confusing, it's complicated, there's conflicting information. It's probably going to be expensive. It's probably going to be so expensive that the traditional way of thinking about these things, which is what's your return on investment going to be, what's the payback period, might not even work. You need to think about these things through a different lens, such as comfort and health and maintenance and resilience. Oh, and also saving money on your bills. But that on its alone, that element of saving money on its own may not be enough.
Yeah, for example, the solar panels, we don't have them on our house at the moment. We have considered it, but the realities of financing a solar panel like that basically means taking out a loan, and basically means that loan extending beyond the point where we actually plan to be living in this house, which puts us in the position of being liable for the loan, but not necessarily getting the benefit of the panels.
Yeah. Some sort of a split incentive problem. Yeah. You won't get the full incentive in the future. So complicated, costly, and disruptive. You know, oftentimes you have to rip your house apart, partially. You've got to pull walls apart. And all of that conspires to people becoming paralyzed. They don't know what to do. They're not sure what good retrofit looks like. And they don't know what a safe pathway is. People are worried about making mistakes and being regretful that they did things in the wrong order. Quite rightly, in a lot of cases, like you do need help navigating this space.
Yeah, I mean, we have seen stories in the news of people getting a house retrofitted and then having all kinds of problems with mold and damp because the cavity wall insulation has stopped the house ventilating properly. Is it a real risk that if people are just left to their own devices, you know, mistakes happen, or if they trust a company that and they haven't built up that trust, mistakes yeah. happen and they end up suffering for it?
Yeah. Well, the risks to retrofit are very real, and they're very well documented, but they're also very able to be successfully navigated. What we need to do with retrofit is take a risk management approach, not a profit first approach, which has tended to be the previous model. So a risk managed approach will essentially navigate the space, because really what you're doing with retrofit is three fundamental things. You're making sure that you've got a degree of insulation so that the fabric of your building is not losing heat more quickly than you're able to add heat to it or cost effectively to it. Think of the furnace, right? You want to keep the inside warm. It all needs to be insulated, not just in parts, but the entire envelope of the building. The second dimension, and really where the problem primarily lies, is it needs to be airtight. Actually, that's not really the right way of putting it. You need to have controlled ventilation, because a house, we have very drafty homes here in the UK compared to other countries. A house that is drafty is really just a house that has uncontrolled ventilation. You don't know where the holes are. You don't know where the gaps are. And there's air coming in and going out of your building. Now, rule of thumb, around about 30% of energy that's lost from a typical building in the UK is from drafts, uncontrolled ventilation. So we make our homes a lot more airtight. But when you make your home a lot more airtight, you reduce its ability to release the moisture. You've got to control the moisture. And the best way to do that is primarily through having controlled ventilation. Now, that might mean having a natural ventilation strategy. So you'll have vents and fans, etc. Or when I say fans, I mean, you know, vents that open, trickle vents on windows, those sorts of things. But when you start to get to a higher degree of energy efficiency, you're probably going to need to have some sort of mechanical fan-based ventilation system. And the gold standard, the ultimate, of course, is probably worth spending your money on, is mechanical ventilation with heat recovery, so that your stale, warm, moist air is removed from the building, but the heat is captured, a very high proportion, 90%+ of the heat is transferred to the cool, fresh, and actually suddenly warm air that's coming in. So I think of it this way. What you're going to end up with after you've retrofitted your home is a warm, cozy home that doesn't have nasty cold spots, it doesn't have drafts, and it's got very fresh, warm, healthy air in it. And once you get to that point, then you've got the third dimension. So insulation, ventilation, and the third dimension is low carbon heating. Mm-hmm. You can look at low carbon heating. The mantra in retrofit is, of course, fabric first. And that means, I think for us, it means we need to get our homes to the point where we can safely install low carbon heating systems such as heat pumps with complete confidence that the energy price is not going to go up. The cost of heating at home is not going to go up. But I don't think that necessarily means we need to insulate and air tightness our homes to the nth degree, because actually that's quite expensive, time consuming, and very cost time consuming and uses a lot of resources. And really, we have a climate emergency, which I think means we need to be decarbonizing our energy. And the best way to decarbonize your energy, if you're in Glasgow and many homes in Scotland, is to get off gas. And far and away, the best, most viable technology for getting us off gas now and probably into the future for almost all homes is going to be a heat pump. Unless, of course, you happen to be in a heat network zone, and it looks like that heat network is definitely going to be built in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I mean, we are in a slightly different dilemma down here in slightly more rural Clydesdale, where we're off gas, but we're near enough to a gas network that if someone happened to be building a district heating system for the village, that would be ideal. But one of the options we have been looking at is biofuel. We converted our oil boiler over to be biofuel ready. But again, that market failure's there. There's no supplier of biofuel in Scotland. So we're still stuck on oil for the foreseeable. Yeah.
And I just think we're so much in the territory of early adopters. You know, we were talking about risks. There's a whole range of risks. What I was primarily trying to sort of hinting at there was that a lot of the risks from retrofit that we primarily think about front of mind when we think about the risk of retrofit is things like make your home too airtight. Don't have adequate ventilation. You're going to have moisture problems. You're going to have mold. You're going to have poor quality air. And that can have really serious impacts. A child died in November in Manchester, in Oldham. It wasn't necessarily a retrofit problem, but it was a ventilation and mold problem. The people can die. But there are other risks. And I think you're sort of touching on another risk, which is we kind of don't know what the future marketplace looks like. Is it going to be heat networks? Is biofuel going to work for us? What's going to work? And one of the key points that I'd really like to get across to people is that when we're in the realm of early adopters, I think we need to stop and ask ourselves, who are the households who are best equipped to take on those risks? We're going to have some households that are retrofitting now and others that are retrofitting their homes later. Do we want the lowest income, most vulnerable, privately owned households to be the ones that are bearing that burden, even if we do give them financial support? Or do we think that perhaps there are some broader shoulders that can bear that risk? And I'm not saying it should be one or the other. I'm just saying we need to think about these things.
And that again brings us into that idea of finding solutions that work for the entire community as a whole, rather than just picking individuals within it.
That's right. Yeah. And so I just think it's kind of wrong to say, look, here's our town, here's our city, whatever, and here's a bunch of households who are fuel poor, low income, vulnerable, whatever. And so let's provide them with some lovely funding, such as Eco4, to retrofit their homes. Problem there is that, yeah, you might end up retrofitting your homes to a high energy standard and it could all be wonderful, but what if it goes wrong? Who's going to come and pick up the pieces? Are those homes going to be left to try and sort it out on their own to, I don't know, somehow exist in a home that has significant health issues when all the contractors and suppliers are pointing their fingers at each other, which is, of course, what happens?
You just mentioned there the UK government's Eco4 scheme. And they have recently extended that scheme. They're starting to extend it to households, not just households that qualify for benefits, but they're starting to push it out to low-income households who don't get benefits as well.
Mm-hmm.
With those risk factors in mind, is this a positive step, or is it still too little and in the wrong place in the wrong way?
Look, I think it is. Look, Eco funding is good funding. It overwhelmingly generates positive outcomes. And the fact that we're talking about Eco4 is a reflection of the fact that it's evolving. And the latest evolution is, as you just said, it's available to potentially more households, which is great. But it's also, for the first time, it's taking a whole building approach, which is absolutely essential. We cannot be thinking about retrofit in terms of single measures, because single measures is proven to result in poor outcomes, including things like performance gap and failure to adequately manage the risks. So it's really important that we have a whole building approach. But Eco4 is, it needs to be there. It needs to continue to evolve and adapt and learn from its mistakes and make further improvements. That's what all our programs need. There's not a question of whether or not Eco4 is good or bad or whatever. It's about, we have a very complicated problem on our hands how are we going to effectively retrofit all of our homes, including various homes that are in various states of repair, built at different times, all sorts of differences. How are we going to navigate that space? And the answer cannot be like this one single magic silver bullet solution. It has to be a range of different solutions. However, having said that, one thing that I think is critical in all of this is that communities, or as I increasingly like find myself saying, people in their community, so people need to be at the center of it all. This idea that people are just passive agents and they'll take what we give them, as long as the government just comes with a top-down program or the big corporate comes with a program, it's all just going to work. That's nonsense. It's proven not to work. We need the top-down, but we also need the bottom-up grassroots, because people have a huge amount of knowledge. Like I said earlier, they've got very legitimate concerns, and we have to bake that in. And that's why we need organizations at the community level like ours to support that rollout of retrofit. So I see a future for Scotland where we have an emerging ecosystem of community-based intermediaries like ourselves. Already there's two or three others that we can point to. There's Nesfit in Northeast Scotland. There's the Edinburgh Initiative, which is not really a single organization. It's a consortium of community organizations, which is excellent. That's what works for them. And I look forward to seeing local intermediaries emerging and flourishing everywhere, including here in Glasgow. The challenge here in Glasgow is too big for us. We want there to be multiple organizations like us doing the work. And who knows, we might not be the right organization for every house. So that's what I think the future looks like.
So I'm going to slightly annoy you with this question, because I know it well. I'm pulling out the magic policy wand. I'm waving it. And Tom Knuckles, I am making you the Minister for Retrofitting Strategy for the UK or the Scottish Government, your choice. What could those governments be doing now that they're not doing to help people get their houses retrofitted?
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to take a very Scottish government-centred view to this. And I think Scottish government should take a lead from the Westminster government on PAST 2035. And Westminster government is doing better work on PAST 2035 than Scotland is. I mean, they're basically further ahead in the adoption, and that's the reason I say that. PAST 2035, for the listeners who are not aware, is a policy, well, it's kind of a standard, but it's a direct response to the failures of retrofit. So there's a litany of really bad outcomes on large-scale retrofit programs that have resulted in huge amounts of damage being done to buildings, really bad health outcomes, load of issues. And it turns out that what was the problem was that the risks of retrofit were not being properly managed, and the needs of the customer needs were not being properly recognized in the delivery of retrofit projects. So Scottish Government is currently considering what to do with PAST 2035, and there are some very worrying noises that we're hearing. So one of the first things I'd say in my new role as Minister of Retrofit would be, we need to be getting PAST 2035 right. Yes, there might be some problems with the way PAST 2035 is being implemented in social housing, but just because there's problems doesn't mean we throw the whole thing in the bin. If we throw PAST 2035 in the bin, we go back to 2010, when those big scale retrofit problems were delivering really bad outcomes. We've actually got a very good framework. We need to improve on it, not throw it away. But don't throw PAST 2035 in the bin. Consumer protections are really important. And on the theme of PAST 2035, don't fall for the line that a retrofit coordinator is an account manager. There was a policy paper from the Scottish Government recently on the supply chain for decarbonising buildings. Hidden in that document was this very worrying line that a retrofit coordinator, by a coordinator, that means the person, the professional who manages the building works to ensure that it meets the design standard and the outcomes it's meant to meet. The role of a retrofit coordinator is primarily an account manager. That's absolutely nonsense. That's not what a retrofit coordinator is. The certificate coordinator is primarily there to serve the needs of the customer and, of course, the builder, which is owned by the customer. And that should be their number one priority. Now, an account manager, their number one priority is in a commercial imperative for their employer, the for-profit company. So to think of a retrofit coordinator as an account manager is madness, and it totally waters down what PAS 2035 should be. Moving on from PAS 2035, there's community wealth building bill on its way. So think about what community wealth building can be achieved with retrofit, which is set to be one of the biggest infrastructure programs to unroll in the coming decades. As you said, $40 billion. To be spent on upgrading our homes. $10 billion, according to Glasgow Region Council, just in Glasgow. So these sums of money are huge. How can that be delivered in a way which also achieves community wealth building? Obviously, look to putting people in the community at the centre. I said a minute ago, look to Westminster for PAS 2035, look to Ireland. In particular, look to Ireland for one-stop shops.
So, yes.
People are finding it very difficult. It's very fragmented. They don't know where to turn for advice and support. This idea of one-stop shops is a single place where you can go to get all the information you need. Now, the shop front, probably virtual, the shop front that you go to is not necessarily going to be the place where you get everything, but they'll be able to bring everything to you via that shop front, the information, the advice, the planning support, the funding support, and ultimately the sort of the supply chain will interface through that one-stop shop front as well. We need to make this easy for people, otherwise they're not going to do it. And I think finally, you know, focus on the resources. Too often I see policy people focusing on the money when actually really what they should be focusing on is the resources. Do we have the real resources to deliver this program? And the most important resource of all, of course, is people. So do we have the people to do retrofit? Are we investing enough in our colleges for training retrofit? That's got to be a critical piece of the puzzle. I think that's probably enough. I've given myself a fairly ambitious program there.
That's quite the remit, yeah. But that last point I actually mentioned on a recent podcast, pointing out that the young apprentice who will be fitting insulation in 2035 is currently in school. The young apprentice who will be fitting insulation in 2045 isn't born yet. Mm-hmm. So we need to be thinking in those timescales for our education policy.
Correct. Yeah, that's right. And I sense that we're going the opposite direction on our training. It's like going the wrong way.
Well, Tom Knuckles, thank you for coming on to this the show. It has been a fantastic chat. Just one final question. Where can folk go to find out more about you, find out more about Local Home, and find out more about your webinars?
Yeah, sure. So best place would be our website, Loco, L-O-C-O. So it's Loco Home, all one word, LOCOHOME.coop, COOP. And I'll just give you one social media handle because it's where we're most active, but we are also on LinkedIn and Facebook. So for Twitter, it's at Loco Retrofit. But you'll find links to our various social media channels on the website. And we're currently working on improving our website. So if you go get there and you feel there's not that much information, have a look at our social media. We'll be making sure that our website's kept up to date in the future.
And I will put links to both of those places in the description of the show.
Yeah. So, and I think as well, like people might be thinking, well, what can they do to, like, if you're in Glasgow, like, what can you do? And what if you're not in Glasgow? Well, the most important thing for us is, like, start to inform yourself about what retrofit even is. Have a look at Loco, decide if you want to become a member. That's the most important step that you can become, that you can take, is to become a member. And also, like, make an inquiry. If you think you might be able to take advantage of our assessment service, make an inquiry, send us an email. will respond to that. If you're not in Glasgow, it's a very collegiate, supportive sector, and do still contact us, but we'll try and point you to people in your local area in Scotland or further afield that are doing similar work as we're doing. So, like I said earlier, I hope to see a really thriving ecosystem of organisations like us all across Scotland, a new wave of community energy, if you like.
I do too. I'm really looking forward to the future in this sector. Well, thank you, Tom. And I'd just like to remind our listeners, as I always do, that Commonweal is entirely funded by our donors and supporters. We don't get government money. We don't have corporate sponsors. We don't even have adverts on our website. So if you'd like to support our policy work, our campaign work, and this podcast, please consider clicking the donate button in the description. Thank you again to my guest. Thank you to everyone listening. And please come back next week. Thank you.